With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Pelle Neroth-Taylor, live from Sweden, on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the second half of the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We've got two excellent guests with us on this hour. We've got Cheryl Chumley, who's a Washington Times opinion editor, who's going to tell us why the dual state solution in the Middle East is nonsense. Most people, most states in the West, Global South, even the United States Biden administration supports, notionally at least, a dual state solution of Palestine and Israel living side by side. But she thinks a Palestinian state will end Israel and eventually America and also the whole West. And we will let her argue her case. At 40 minutes past the hour, we've got Professor Alan Stamm, who will tell us what actually happened during those 100 days of killing in 1994 when the Rwandan genocide took place and launched Western foreign policy in a new direction. He says that he has been threatened by members of the Rwandan government and individuals around the world for exposing the truth, which is completely at odds with the sort of Samantha Power's simplistic genocide against the Tutsis story. But we talked about that last week, and he's got some more. He spent a lot of years doing field work and very interesting stories he's got to tell. But first, we'll just say a little bit about Israel. It seems as if World War III has been off for the moment, at least on the latest. I was reading the New York Times this morning, which, of course, is the closest paper to the US administration, along with the Washington Post. The Brits are not really, British press are not really reliable on these things as regards to what the administration is thinking. And I don't often agree with the New York Times, but their main column on their front page talks about a diplomatic success for Biden and his diplomats at building an international coalition to help protect Israel, which kind of gives them the kind of self-confidence, at least for the moment, not to not to fight against Iran after this attack at the weekend. And you can argue the rights and wrongs are the biggest story, but whatever stops an Israeli counterstrike, in my view, is the most important thing. If Israel had struck back at Iran after the weekend's attack, we would probably get a large counterstrike by a much larger Iranian attack. They've got stocks of missiles, which they built up, even hypersonic missiles, which no one can stop. And we must not forget that Israel is very small geographically and population-wise, 8 million very successful and talented people, but they are living on a very small territory, whereas Iran is big and mountainous and has a population 10 times larger or something than Israel, or 6 or 7. Of course, Israel could then escalate to the so-called Samson option, which is nuking everyone around them. But of course, that will have absolutely incalculable consequences. And who wants to be the winning corpse in an ash heap of world peace? So, but of course, Israel's been playing this game. We don't know if they're mad or not. And it's partly part of the poker bluff, I guess, that's been in the Middle East. But I certainly wouldn't want all our lives to be up stakes in this poker game, because of course it'll affect us in Europe as well as the world's oil supplies and God knows what else. So the US assembled a coalition of Arab states like Jordan and Saudi, which helped that to shoot down those missiles, some of them that were coming Israel's way, and created a sort of feel-good feeling, but also a Western coalition, not NATO, which is a military coalition, don't forget, but the G7, which is large economic powers, America's closest allies, Britain, France, Canada, and they've all been bombarding the media with their don't escalate calls. I always wondered if that would work with Netanyahu and the Israelis, who might be tempted to do exactly the opposite of what they've been strongly recommended. But it seems as if things have calmed down and the daily headlines are moving on to other things like the Trump case in New York and whether Israel can build a sanctions coalition. As long as you talk about words like sanctions and less about pictures of attack with unhelpful photographs of jets revving up, then that's good news as far as I'm concerned. So it's a combination of blandishments, flattery, maybe a lot of back channel diplomacy. Maybe the Russians were involved. The Russian head of intelligence or head of security council there, Nikolai Petrushev, had a very low key call with his Israeli counterpart. And of course, Russia has not involved itself very publicly in the Russian media. I haven't talked about Israel very much, but They might have put pressure on the background. They might have restrained Iran. They might have issued subtle threats to Israel. China might have played a part in putting economic pressure or withdrawing support in this or that. We don't know. But it seems to me that give credit where credit is due. I think a lot of Trumpists won't give Biden the credit for anything and say he's insufficiently hawkish. But surely hawkishness is not the order of the day here. What we'll talk about, though, is a spirited case for the opposite, which is that Israel ought to have attacked Iran this weekend. And we'll hear that after a very quick news analysis from Basil Valentine, our political editor, and he will be with us after the next break. This is the Pelinero Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Giving you what you want.
I want the facts.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelinero Taylor Show. We've got Basil Valentine with us, the political editor. Can I just ask you, Basil, because this is a question I've been struggling with. I'm all for telling the truth and telling it as it is and exposing things as a kind of journalist. But suppose the Iranians really had bombed. Officially, you know, that 99% of the drones were caught by either Israeli, American, British, French, Saudi, anti-aircraft defense, or their planes sending anti-aircraft missiles, anti-missile missiles, whatever you call it in technical terms. So 99% were brought down. No one died in Israel. No serious damage. But there's been rumors on Twitter that one airbase was, in fact, damaged quite seriously, and the Iranians really sent a signal there. I don't know if it's true. I haven't investigated it. But let's suppose it's true, right? And you, Basil, were a journalist sitting in Israel. You're working for a large Israeli newspaper. You found out that this was true, and you could get a great scoop if you published it. But that scoop would risk a danger of escalation, because you'd publish it and say, well, a lot of Israelis were killed at this airbase. The Iranians really did do damage. Would your conscience allow you to have that published, or would you keep quiet about it? You could get a big boost in your career if you published it, but you would also make an Israeli strike on Iran and maybe World War III more likely.
I wouldn't dream of publishing it, Pele. Certainly not. Does the rumours suggest that Israeli military personnel were actually killed at the weekend? Because
no, I think I didn't. I'm sort of superstitious about it, so I didn't even go down that route, because I've probably spent hours down. There's a lot of propaganda, a lot of exaggerations. All the normally reliable sources on, like, say, the Ukraine conflict are going, I think, really overboard on this thing. So I didn't even bother to investigate. But I was just thinking about it, and I agree with you. I mean, I would, free speech, honestly, but there's some limits, and I would keep absolutely the lid on that story anyway.
My understanding is that the weekend raid was very fully choreographed with the Israelis.
That's right. I think it was.
It turns out it was almost an act of theatre. Yes,
right.
There was a demonstration of power, but there was no real intent to do major damage. And one girl was injured. That's it. The Israelis willing to launch World War III on the basis of an injury to one individual. Let's hope not. Simon Jenkins, writing in The Guardian today, wants to know what on earth Britain was doing being involved, citing it as a war over territory, as is the case in Sudan, Yemen, Syria, and Myanmar, all of which have been very dangerous grounds for European and American adventurers in recent years. But we have no business there. There's no question that it's nothing to do with us. There's no threat to British security at all. So what on earth were we doing taking sides?
Well, I mean, it kind of relates to the discussion I wanted to have, but which is far too short on the slot allotted, which is, should the Foreign Office be reformed? Should British foreign policy be reformed? I mean, I've said this again and again. I think there ought to be some kind of commission after all this, you know, because Brexit was incomplete. You decided what you didn't like, which was Europe. But what do you actually want you know, where is Britain heading in this multipolar world, you know?
I mean, that's a very good question. A lot of people are calling for major reform of the Foreign Office. A report came out just a week or two ago saying that the Foreign Office is absolutely mired in the past and still has a lot of neo-colonial attitudes. You know, when we still have the Commonwealth, which is the sort of relic of empire, isn't it? Was tremendously important to the Queen, of course, who used to cultivate relationships with these various potentates around the world. But I want to bring things back to, all the noise over the last few days has, of course, been about the possibility of World War III. What will the Israelis do next? And a lot of very alarmist talk about the danger posed to Israeli civil society. Meanwhile, within the last hour, a police vehicle believed to be one of the vehicles tasked with the security of delivering aid and maintaining some sort of order in Gaza has been destroyed with all eight occupants killed in the Tufar neighborhood in the eastern part of Gaza City. I've also seen a report on social media that the Israelis have been flying drones with the sound, pre-recorded sound of a baby crying coming out of the drone, and then anybody emerging from the rubble to find out what this noise is all about and perhaps provide some comfort to the crying baby is shot. It's difficult to think of a more sinister way of targeting people than that. I mean, you know, is this still supposed to be about Hamas? In which case, why are eight security personnel supposedly looking after aid being killed? Perhaps you'd like to ask your next guest that.
Where are these security personnel from?
Well, they were Palestinian.
Do we have any details?
Ah,
oh, okay,
Palestinian,
right.
Yeah, okay. Palestinian police, you know.
Okay.
So I suppose it, with their twisted logic, the Israelis could say that they're Gaza, that they are Hamas too, you know.
And what about the drone with the baby? What's your source for that?
My source for that is social media, I must admit.
Right.
But there's a clip of it. There is a live clip, you know, thousands of likes and reposts and all the rest of it. We can't verify these things. I'm not there. Do you know what I mean? But it wouldn't surprise me, you know. Thousands of civilians have been killed. And yet, just when diplomatic support for Israel was ebbing away, suddenly the US, UK, all the usual suspects rally to the cause, you know. Over the weekend, we must defend Israel at all costs. So the rhetoric has changed. And that was Netanyahu's objective in the first place when he bombed the...
Yeah, but I mean, don't you think, whatever you think of the Gaza-Israel conflict, I mean, everything, they have to be expedient there, because even if they didn't agree with Netanyahu, and maybe some of them do, but even if they didn't, you have to butter up Netanyahu, for God's sake, just to stop them launching missiles, you know. So you have to say nice things to them and say, we've got your back and stuff, because otherwise they might attack Iran, don't you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you said, strangely, the semi-incompetent Biden White House is ironically something of an asset at this time, because there are all sorts of hotheads on Capitol Hill calling for, you know, bombing of Tehran by the United States, you know, hit them hard, tweeted Lindsey Graham over the weekend. Absolute nonsense, insanity. And, you know, even Donald Trump, who likes to claim this would never have happened had he been in power, is more hawkish. So the fact that we've got this flimsy administration is ironically something of an advantage at the moment. I don't really believe in buttering up Netanyahu. He only really listens to power. He thrives on weakness, as has been demonstrated countless times in the past. And obviously he's got his own survival. Just to bring us up to date, Vladimir Putin, in a phone call with Iran's President Raisi, has emphasized the need for calm and that hopes that Iran does not further inflame tensions. European Union nations are eyeing extended sanctions on Iran after the attack. So one girl injured in Israel as a result of the offensive retaliation, seven Iranian personnel killed by Israel in Damascus, 35,000 killed, civilians killed in Gaza, but no sanctions on Israel. They want to sanction Iran for injuring one individual.
I know. I mean, the double standards are quite incredible, aren't they?
They really are.
So, but of course, I think we might come to a head in Sweden in a few weeks' time, where the Eurovision Song Contest, this Kumbaya meeting where people gather around and sing about peace and love and transgender and all the rest of it. And it's taking place in Malmo this year. And Malmo is a quite heavily Muslim city, or the most Muslim city in Scandinavia. And Israel is fielding a young girl, very pretty, very nice. She sings a very nice song. But will that whole thing be a focus for protests and maybe worse? Anyway, Basil, great to have you on again. We'll talk more tomorrow. And this is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. And our third guest is coming on after a quick break.
TNT's Joseph Arthur.
There was already lines being drawn in the sand because there was people resisting every step of the way. I was one of them. I was resisting the mask, and I was like questioning that openly on social media. And old friends were going like, you know, calling me an idiot and all this other stuff.
The data coming out of Israel showing that there was basically no efficacy with this vaccine, with the Delta variant. And so we knew what was coming. And at that point, we thought that the health agencies were actually going to try to be honest with the public and say, okay, the vaccines actually didn't work. We've got this new variant, you know, and try to maneuver out of it, which would then open up the door a little bit for the mainstream to go, oh, there's people being harmed. We've got some problems here. Okay, let's start talking about this. But instead, what they did is they doubled down, tripled down, quadrupled down on their narrative, as you saw, and they fueled this all-out war against the people like yourself who were awake. They saw the BS coming from a mile away, and they were just asking questions.
Joseph Arthur and his Technicolor Dreamcast on today's News Talk TNT. TNTRadio.live.
Online.
Online.
Online streaming.
Be a part of the conversation.
I stream it all at work, and I stream it to my phone and listen to it wherever I go.
TNT.
Very welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. Our highly recommended guest, Cheryl Chumley, who's the online opinion editor of the Washington Times. She's the host of the Bold and Blunt podcast, an author, commentary writer, public speaker, and media guest. She's also a private investigator, and she can be found on www.cherylchumley.com and tweets at ckchumley. Welcome to the show, Cheryl. We're going to talk about a little bit about Israel and the conflict there. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Good. You feel, we were just talking about Israel before the break, you've written quite a lot of articles, and I'll just read out the titles. The Stupidity of the Two-State Solution for Israel and Palestinians, Biden is Bad for America, Bad for Israel, Bad All Around, Narrative Shifts as World's Compassion Wrongly Falls to Palestinians, UNRWA, which emerging as the new terror headache for Israel, and Hamas shooting their own people. Now, I just want to say, I think there's one thing that I really agree with is a possibility here, and I'm going to read it out in a second, because it's quite, I mean, let's see. You wrote in one of your pieces, think about it. Hamas knows it doesn't have the capability to win a direct war with Israel, so its plan on October 7 was twofold. And then you quote a scholar, or draw IDF into Gaza, where terrorists could then pick off the Jewish soldiers from behind entrenched hidden spots via booby traps and guerrilla hits, and use the power of a heavily propagandized press to post photos that paint the Palestinians as the victims, and that push that the international community demand of a ceasefire. Basically, that it was a political act, and using the population of Gaza as human shields, basically. They knew that their their wives and daughters or sons would be massacred and create an enormous impetus against Israel. Do you think, if you assume that's true, and it's not, I mean, I followed the Yugoslav war because I was down there, and I know, for instance, that the Bosnians shelled their own people to create an international case for intervention. So people, armies can be very ruthless with their own civilians. Given all that, assume that's true, do you think it was wise for Israel to do what it's done in Gaza the last since October 7?
You mean counterattack?
Yeah, the level of counterattack, and to what extent could things have been done differently if they were going to earn the world's approbation or approval or support?
Well, let me just answer briefly. I'll say yes, okay? I think Israel was quite right in doing what it did in terms of going after Hamas in Gaza. And the articles that you quote from are opinion pieces, and they came from my 15-day trip to Israel to cover war-related issues for the Washington Times, where I'm online opinion editor. And I just got back from Israel. When I say just, I mean just a few days ago. And so during my investigations there, my research, my interviews, I have to say that the Israeli people, first off, and this is no surprise, are quite right in defending their nation from terrorists. And the idea that they would stand down at the very time where they had almost eradicated the terror organization Hamas in Rafah, because the West, America, and many in global governments were calling for them to stand down, to me, I find that abhorrent. If I was being attacked in my own home, my goal would be to get the attackers, to kill the attackers, to stop the attackers. And if I had somebody who was telling me that I don't have a right to do that, I would take offense with that.
Okay, well, I mean, there are two issues. One is what is realistic, and the other thing is what is moral proportionately. I mean, how many of those Palestinians who were killed are innocent? And I speak as, I mean, I guess, of course, the British in World War II killed hundreds of thousands of Germans in the name of winning the war, you know, by the firebombings of Hamburg and so on. And that's never been really discussed, but we're kind of living in the 2020s now. Do you think, are they more likely to win this? Because even Israel needs international, I mean, it's a small country and it needs it needs support, at least from America. So are the Israelis being realistic, or are they just going for what they believe in right? Or do they think they can win this? What is your feeling?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I wouldn't look at that as a premise that I would agree with. So let's remember that the narrative here has shifted. Israel was the one that was attacked, right? The Israeli citizens were going about their own business on October 7th when they were attacked by evil, savage, brutal terrorists who struck first at youth who were attending a music festival. And they didn't just shoot them down. They gunned them down. They raped them. They cut off their body parts. They tortured them. They abducted them. They still hold hostages, not just Jewish hostages, but American hostages as well. And so to let that go and pretend that Israel is doing something wrong by going after those who attacked and struck them mercilessly and without cause, that's sort of a premise that I don't go along with. I believe Israel has full right to defend itself. And I do think that they will win, so long as the international community, including Joe Biden's White House, does not interfere.
But I mean, then you come into the real question. The realist question is, the fact is that Israel is losing support around the world. I mean, this is something that unites basically the adversaries: China, Russia, Turkey, Britain, America. Israel has lost support, only briefly halted by this event, you know, the shelling or the missile attacks on Saturday. And even that, I think, was slightly instrumental, because people feel they're dealing with a madman who has to be assuaged and dealt with calmly before he blows up the whole world. But I mean, the long-term trend is that Israel is losing support, and you don't have any alternative supply lines. Like, the Russians can rely on China. They're very unpopular, but you're a small country that you can traverse in what, half an hour by car? How are you going to, you can't take on the entire world. What is your power to take on the entire world, except your negative power to nuke the entire world if people don't listen to you?
So the point you're making then, if I'm to read into it properly, is to suggest that because Israel doesn't have the support of the world, that they should need to sort of walk a more diplomatic walk here and listen to what the rest of the world is saying and to act accordingly. And I would answer that by saying, why is the rest of the world not supporting Israel? Israel is standing alone here, making the correct argument, if you want to put it in those terms. They're making the correct fight. And the fact that the rest of the world is turning its back on Israel does not show so much the error of Israel's way as it does show the error of the other governments of the world's way.
Okay. Really interesting discussion we're having here. We're just going to go into a quick news break with news headlines. So this is the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show, back after a break on the topic of Israel. Thanks a lot.
I got news.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. President Joe Biden has declined to testify in the impeachment inquiry led by House Republicans, labeling it a partisan charade. Following Iran's mass missile and drone attack, Israel's war cabinet has decided on a clear and decisive response, which will adhere to U.S. guidelines. Former President Donald Trump on April 15th became the first U.S. president to stand trial on criminal charges.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show. We've got the brilliant Cheryl Chumley with us, who's an online opinion editor at the Washington Times. She hosts the Blunt and Bold and Blunt podcast and can be found at www.cherylchumley.com. She's just been to Israel and captured public opinion there, written a lot of interesting pieces. I recommend you check them out on our website. Welcome back to the show, Cheryl. We were just talking about what Israel... Let's assume that Israel is right. But I mean, sometimes even doing the moral thing is not going to lead you to a better result, is it? I mean, you've got to have some realism. If the whole world is against you, what are you going to do? I mean, what are you going to do? Are you going to nuke the world if people don't agree with you? Because that's your only real power. At some point, you're going to have to, I mean, at some point, America might cut off its funding because, of course, increasingly American opinion is turning against you. And then other countries might sanction you. You can't live off sanctions, unlike Russia and China, because you're not a very big country. I mean, so there's one thing is what you ought to do, and there's one that says what can you do and what is realistic to do. Is that kind of calculation going on in Israel, or are you absolutely set on the path that you're going down?
Well, I don't think morality is dictated by 51%, right? You don't need the majority to dictate what morality is. And if that's the standard, then you can look back on world history and see how that has led into so much trouble, right? It's not the fact that the majority agree that dictates something is moral or just. It's the fact that it's moral or just. And if you're a Christian, as I am, you take that morality from the Bible and biblical truths. And in Israel, of course, they have the Judeo-Christian principle that guides much of what they do, or the Judaic principle. So if you're looking for the moral fight here, the moral cause, you have to side with the one that says evil is wrong and evil should be eradicated. And if you look at October 7th, the sides are clear here. You have the side of morality, and then you have the side of evil. And so you have to make a stand on fighting that evil. And even if the world turns and public opinion turns and wants to just calm the the fight and the chaos that evil started, that doesn't mean you can go quietly back into that good night and pretend that the evil is not going to advance. Because if Israel were to stop now based on public opinion, then guaranteed that would only embolden the evil further, and they would stand for many more attacks in Israel and against the West, by the way.
Okay. What makes you think that, first of all, I mean, there's a question of proportionality, because, I mean, okay, so they killed in an absolutely brutal and inexcusable manner over 1,000 innocent Israelis on October 7. But of course, I mean, even in foreign policy, this American very establishment magazine, a guy called Stephen Walt, who's a Harvard professor, says, you know, you could make the case that the treatment of the Palestinians down the decades makes that justifiable. I'm not going to recite his arguments, but it's out there, and he's a very well-known professor. You want to avenge that, okay? And a lot of people have agreed with you, a lot of global opinion, but they don't think that killing 33,000 Palestinians at a current ratio of 33-1 of the sacrifices or the deaths that you suffered on October 7, or the Israelis got, is proportionate. How many more are going to die? 100,000, 200,000?
Well, first off, the 33,000 figure comes from Hamas's side. So how much are you going to trust that? And let's just say that they're correct. 33,000 of Gazans had died. Then you have to sift through and decide, well, how many of those are innocent civilians versus Hamas terrorists? And that's where it gets a little bit sticky, right? Because that's where you get scholars weigh in and say, well, there were X amount of innocent Israelis die, so only X amount of innocent Palestinians should die as well. But innocence is sort of an interesting word here, because in the eyes of you and me, we may define innocent as people who are just trying to go about their day-to-day operations, just trying to educate their children and provide for their families and so forth. But innocent in Gazan language is something completely different. For instance, the innocent Palestinians, by and large, had tunnels under their homes that they were aware of that were used by Hamas terrorists to commit atrocities against the Jewish people. These same innocent Palestinians, civilians, also had weapons of war, RPGs, machine guns, and other articles of warfare used by Hamas terrorists stored in their innocent civilian homes. At the same time, you had the innocent civilians in the Palestinian-dominated Gaza area vote for Hamas by a vast majority a couple years ago. So they knew what they were getting with Hamas, and yet they voted them into office anyhow. And then fourthly, you have the response of the innocent Palestinian civilians after the Hamas terror attacks on Israel, which was largely documented on video as being seen as cheering and applauding and outright supporting what Hamas did. And fifthly and finally, you have the polls that have come out of the Gazan territories that show the innocent Palestinian civilians today still support what Hamas did and is doing against the Jewish people. So you say innocent civilians in Gaza, and I ask, which ones in particular?
Okay. Can you just, you were saying that if Israel doesn't act now, America will suffer. It'll be the end of America and ultimately the end of West. And I speak as someone who's based in Sweden, whose society has been transformed by Islamic immigration, and I'm very against that, okay? But I mean, just being against immigration doesn't mean you believe in killing people or whatever. We got to a minute and a half. Can you expand on that argument? Because you wrote it just a line. How is Israel defending the West?
So the war Israel is making against terrorism is not just Israel's war in a bubble, right? The same terrorists who are chanting death to Israel, death to the Israelis, death to the Jews, are the ones who are also chanting death to America, death to the West. So if they are successful in their eradication of the Jewish people and the destruction of the Jewish nation, those in the world who think that that's the end of it, that they will just live their lives, are wrong, because they put in their chants what their next goal is. And so Israel's war against terrorism should be all of civil society's, America's and the West's, fight against terrorism as well.
Okay. Just moving on, we've got you in on for a little bit longer. You just came back from Israel, and that's an incredible advantage, having been on the ground and actually talked to people, unlike us talking heads sitting here. What's the mood in Israel? Is this a very contested issue, or is the country quite united?
Israel feels very much alone right now. And that was something that was repeated by numerous people I spoke with about their awareness of the politics around the world. As far as the Jewish people being united, there are political differences, especially over Benjamin Netanyahu, but on Benjamin Netanyahu's promise to eradicate Hamas and destroy the terrorist forces that threaten Israel, all are united. There is no politics about that.
Okay, now let's just move on because we've got a bit longer than I thought. Talk about what you feel about this weekend's attack, the Iranian attack. You think that Israel should strike back. What the consequence of that might be, a serious escalation. I don't know what Israel's going to do, but I mean, if Iran has all these hypersonic missiles, whatever you do to Iran, you might be eradicated. Isn't that rather suicidal? Thing to do, to strike out at Iran?
Well, it's only suicidal because Joe Biden has gone out there and telegraphed to the world, including Iran and the terror forces, that America does not support Israel's counterattack on Iran, and that America would not stand by and support Israel if it did attack Iran. These things, you have to step back from because these things are very difficult to deal with in a bubble. So the reason Israel is facing such hostility right now, from Hamas first, then Hezbollah, and now Iran, is because this White House under Joe Biden has telegraphed a message around the world that Israel, yes, has the support of America, but only up until a certain point. And the terror forces around the world have exploited that weak messaging and launched attacks on Israel, now putting Israel in a bind, like you rightly point out. What are they going to do that's pragmatic, that will work? But with America in a weakened state right now under this administration, it's a rock and a hard place.
Do you think Trump is going to be an improvement from the Israeli perspective?
Yes. Yes.
Because even a lot of people, I mean, I'm quite pro-Trump, but maybe not on this question. But he's been making his most critical comments so far, I think, hasn't he? We've talked about Israel making bad PR for itself. So I guess the Israelis are watching very closely. But how is the rest of Israeli opinion looking forward to a Trump? In what way will they have he will have their back in the way that Biden hasn't?
So the Jewish people that I spoke with over in Israel about Trump versus Biden, or even Barack Obama versus Trump versus Biden, were pretty clear on this one point. Under Trump, it was more peaceful. Under Joe Biden, it is not. And so that's where they take their factual opinion from. That's not to say that all are 100% in support of Trump, but they do see a very clear difference in the administrations.
Do you see, are you back in the States now?
Yes.
What's the feeling in America now? Are you in New York or Washington maybe? Shift? What has been it? Because here I am sitting in Europe just relying on the press, but they say that young people and even young Jews especially are turning against Israel. Is that something that you notice in your face-to-face meetings?
It's very interesting to me, as it has been to many people over the years, why Democrats why Jewish people in America consistently vote Democrat. And the usual line of logic is that Israel was founded on a socialist type of ideology. And so, many Jewish people carried that politic with them. And they also saw how many Christians over the years maybe haven't treated Jewish people as kindly as they would have liked. So they see that as well. They see Democrats as being more open with entitlement type programs. And so they have voted accordingly. But this October 7th attack has sort of shifted a lot of the Jewish people's mindset. It has opened many eyes to those in the Jewish community, both in Israel and from people I spoke with in Israel, they think in America as well, that that progressive mindset that if they only work with the Palestinian people, offer them jobs and medical treatments and and befriend them, that that will make the Palestinian people likewise befriend the Jewish people. That did not happen. October 7th was an eye opener. And now with Iran attacking them, that's the second eye opener. So I think there is a shift occurring.
And I mean, to some extent, I do. I am not unsympathetic to some of your arguments, because I mean, there's a debate in Sweden now, which of course has seen its demographics all over Europe change utterly, and we've seen a really peaceful country turn having the Europe's largest level of gun violence. And the, as I was just saying earlier, the Muslim community and some of those Muslim or migrant heavily dominated suburbs, people have terrible lives. And then you have guardians, as it were, standing as you arrive on the tube or the metro, and they look you over if you have the wrong, if you're not wearing a headscarf or not. And of course, many of the anti-immigration politicians in Europe are very pro-Israel, but it's really split people down the middle. What you call the alt-right is really completely divided between the ones who are really loyal to Israel and the ones who are not loyal at all. So people talk about it. But we've got our next guest. Unfortunately, we have to bring them in and cover quite a lot on that topic. But it was great to have you on. Really good to have a refreshing discussion. Well, Cheryl Chumley, online opinion editor at The Washington Times, and who's just visited Israel and written a lot of articles, cherylchumley.com and, I guess, Washington Times. Thank you very much, Cheryl. Thank See you again. All right, thanks.
She used to dance and dream of a better life, a brighter future, with nutritious food to eat, a chance to learn, to get an education, and do incredible things. Today, thanks to Children International and friends like you, she dances for the world. Together, we give children in poverty a chance to set their sights high and achieve their dreams by ensuring that they have access to healthcare, education, life skills, and more, so they can grow, thrive, and believe in themselves.
Gracias. Gracias.
Learn more about Children International and join us in our life-changing work at children.org today.
Even the thought of dementia can feel scary. It's why we put off getting help, even though we've noticed changes in our thinking or memory. But an early diagnosis can change everything, giving you medical help and a support system around you to help you live better. Start with Dementia Australia's online checklist, because the sooner you know, the more you can do.
From the Cold War to propaganda and the deep state,
Pella Neuroth Taylor
on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Neuroth Taylor Show. This final guest on this Tuesday afternoon, we're going to talk about Rwanda and the genocide there again today. We did it last week. And I'll just remind people that Rwanda was one of the big moral causes of the mid-1990s. 1994, there was a genocide that killed a million Rwandans in very short order and actually led to a new moralistic direction in Western foreign policy, I'd say. Intervene to stop genocides, intervene in the name of good intentions. The real intentions might have been different, but officially that was a kind of guiding light for foreign policy for a while, and it's got ramifications till this day because it's often proved counterproductive, as we saw in Libya. But we won't really talk about that. We'll just talk about the a revisionist view of Rwanda, who actually killed and when. We've got Alan Stamm, who's a distinguished university professor of public policy and politics at the University of Virginia. Before that, he was the dean of the Batten School of Leadership and Public Policy. His books include Democracy at War from Princeton University Press, Leaders Fight from the Cambridge University Press. He's led survey-based projects in Russia, Rwanda, India, and the United States. And his work on the Rwandan genocides overturns the conventional wisdom and been featured in numerous accounts. He's won the Victoire Ingibire Umuhoza Prize for Democracy and Peace, and also the David Singer Data Innovation Award by the American Political Science Association. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I thought that was that documentary that you were in, the BBC one, which is kind of in memory hold. I don't think it's not even mentioned in the Wikipedia page on the Rwanda genocide. Brilliant documentary, and you made some brilliant contributions. So I thought we'd pick up there, because you went back to Rwanda in 98, 99, 5 years after the genocide, and did a lot of field work to discover what really happened. So can you tell us what you found and what your field work consisted of? And we'll take it from there.
Sure. So my colleague and I, Christian Davenport, we went back to Rwanda first because we were reacting to some work that had said the United States and the European countries and the UN couldn't have done anything to stop the killing. And that struck us as somewhat misguided. And so we wanted to go and sort of look at the country, look at the way things were actually on the ground. We were very fortunate to be, Christian and I taught a couple of classes at the same time in the National University in Butare there. And one of the projects that we were training our students on was survey research. And so for their capstone or thesis projects, we had them design their own surveys and then go execute these surveys throughout the country. Well, it turned out many of our students actually had not been in Rwanda in 1994. They were part of the Tutsi diaspora in Toronto, in Belgium, in London, and places like that. And so they were also very curious to find out what it had been like on the ground in these various locations, particularly in the southern and western parts of the country. Well, they came back after spending their 2 weeks interviewing people. And one of the things that was very surprising was that people of all types had been afraid. People, whether they were Hutu or Tutsi, people that had been Hutu, not surprisingly, were concerned about the RPF, who had come in and invaded the country. The Tutsi were concerned, not surprisingly, because the Hutu and the FAR had been killing Tutsi with reckless abandon. And this sort of sense just struck us as different from the standard story, which is the RPF invaded from Uganda to stop the genocide. And so this was sort of down a thorny path of trying to figure out what actually happened. And part of the challenge we faced was that what happened varied a lot depending on where you were in the country.
Mm. Well, you give a much more nuanced picture because, as I understand it, as I said, the official story, and I guess we will remember from what we read in the headlines, and then we don't read the revisionist accounts, not even someone who's a current affairs interested as I am, because we don't have time or it doesn't get the original the exposure that the original headlines did. So my knowledge of it was mired in the standard story. As you said, it was the Hutus massacred the Tutsis after a plane crash of the president of Rwanda and Burundi. And then the RPF, the Rwandan Popular Front or whatever, came in, led by Paul Kagame, who's a famous figure still today. The Brits are about to send a lot of asylum seekers his way. So you Brits out there, watch this segment closely. And he's kind of a hero, a white knight, a sort of, and then he did all these democratic reforms, a darling of the West, you know, Rwanda became English speaking and did all these brilliant reforms and Rwanda's successful and so on. You can't touch Kagame. But it said, you said, well, for a start, you know, far more Hutus than we think died because the numbers wouldn't add up otherwise. And that goes against the, let's say, the official story that, you know, a few thousand Hutus died, but then large numbers of Tutsis were massacred. And you find that the figures are much more, well, tell us what the death figures are according to your fieldwork.
So the first thing we have to say is there's no way to know for sure. So you have to remember, this is a, if not the poorest country on earth, one of the handful of poorest countries on earth. Shortly after the genocide begins or the civil war escalates dramatically, all the Western reporters leave. And so our ability to know exactly what happened is limited even till today. Best we can figure is that the number of Hutu that were killed is roughly equal to, or if anything, greater than the number of Tutsi that were killed. Now, there's an important caveat here. This is not denying that a genocide took place. There is no question that the Hutu government and military and their paramilitary organization, the Interahamwe, deliberately planned and executed a genocide of the Tutsi. What has not been discussed often are two other things that happen. One is, so roughly half of the country's population is on the move. By the end of the summer, more than half of the country's population is either dead or a refugee somewhere else compared to where they had been living a few months earlier. So the ethnic identity is very closely tied to one's physical and family location. So with everyone moving, it becomes much more difficult at the time for people to know who's who in terms of their ethnic identity. And so we believe that based on thousands of witness statements, again, these aren't our research, these are using other people's investigation, but that there were literally tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Hutu that were killed, probably as a result simply of mistaken identity. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Then there were huge reprisal killings by the RPF. So the RPF, the RPF claimed that they invaded to stop the killing. But in fact, I'm very certain of this, that the RPF would move into areas after the killing, the first genocidal killing, had been completed. So not surprisingly, RPF members would arrive in places where they had long distance family members or who they knew people that had family in these areas, and they saw the devastation and they took out their frustration on the local people that were still living there. And so there are huge numbers of reprisal killings. There are also large numbers. There's no order. The police are gone. Military, for the most part, is gone because they're moving from place to place to kill people. And so one of the things that we see, not just in Rwanda, but all over the world, whenever there's no order provided by police forces, whether they're civilian or military, we see a lot of violence. And so there was just extraordinary kinds of violence of all types, including genocide violence, including reprisals, including random killings, including killings of mistaken identity. It's sort of the worst of human nature.
I just want to read out a section from a recent interview you did, which is beautifully describes the situation with a lot of... I interviewed a lot of people died in, this is what you say, all right, a lot of people died at roadblocks. A roadblock would be a footpath with two trash cans and a stick across it. Roadblocks were manned by young boys between the ages of 8 and 17. Most of these kids were stone cold drunk. The policy here was to bring these groups of kids every night to a jerry can filled with banana beer. Now we know that these places were terrifying because the handful of journalists actually operating during this period described coming across these roadblocks saying they were absolutely terrifying. You have armed kids drunk out of their minds that have been participating in killing sprees, so anyone that shows up in the dark can be killed. Now you might say, well, people had identification papers and everything. Well, it turns out they did have identification papers. They had a slip of paper. The identification cards for these papers, people is a slip of paper. They're pretty warm and sweaty place. Imagine a thin slip of paper being all that you have. It's not like a US passport. We think mass killings, around 500,000 people died here. So here, very, very graphically, you're giving us a picture of how the way millions of people, not millions, hundreds of the tens of thousands, whatever, large numbers of people were killed by young children drunk at a checkpoint because they have sweated out their identification papers that could have saved their lives. The really evocative picture of the kind of randomness as well of the death and the sort of the low level. I mean, it's a situational thing rather than there was the organized genocide at the beginning by the Hutus, almost like a sort of Jewish Holocaust thing. But then it was much more complicated than that and much more random in general. Is that what you like wanted to say, basically?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we were trying to explain, both in the description of what took place at those roadblocks and also by acknowledging that the different ways that people were threatened, killed, were so extraordinarily varied, that we're trying to convey how terrifying Rwanda must have been as a place to have to be for months on end, which would have been has been traumatizing to a huge fraction of the entire public in that country, which we believe is one of the reasons that facilitated Paul Kagame's ability to take control of the country and then retain power for all these years since.
We've got to kind of wind up here. So we've got about a minute. We can have you on again. These interviews have to be very short because of the schedule. But We've got Paul Gamat Kagame, who's a kind of hero, an ally of the British. He's even brought in the English language. And the trials, human rights trials based on the Nuremberg model, only seem to implicate Tutus. The Tutsis got off free. Do you think that we should re-explore the whole Paul Kagame and the Rwanda genocide? Is it relevant today at a time when Brits and other Europeans are thinking of sending a lot of people to Rwanda? You've got 40 seconds to summarize.
Absolutely, it's relevant today. And the reason is we have a dictator in Central Africa that essentially receives support from European Union countries, the United States. This is a guy, so 6 months, 2 years ago, I had two FBI agents show up on my front door and tell me that I was on a list marked for death at the order of Paul Kagame. Well, is this the way we want to live in our world, where researchers that are trying to not hide any of the past, but make the past come alive so we can better understand it, they should actually be targeted for reprisals? I don't think that's the kind of world we want to live in.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Alan Stamm. A brilliant exposition of what went on in Rwanda. I can advise you to look at his book and look at his talks. Just Google his name and lots of stuff will come up. And we'll try and have you on again for a more in-depth conversation on the topic. Thank you very much, Professor. This is the Pelin Nerov Taylor Show. We're all done for today, Tuesday. And we will talk to you tomorrow at the same time, starting 3 p.m. British, 4 p.m. Swedish. Thank you very much.